This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LLAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
I want to live to see my kids and my kids' kids and my kids' kids' kids. You know, I want to see my descendants and enjoy them and live a full life where I can interact with them and be, you know, cognitively sharp.
Hello and welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. I'm Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. This episode is brought to you in association with Amazentis, a Swiss life science company that's pioneering cutting-edge, clinically validated cellular nutrition under its Timeline brand. Now, let food be thy medicine, and let medicine be thy food. The quote attributed to Hippocrates, the Greek physician, sometimes described as the founder of Western medicine. That quote is often associated with the health benefits of a balanced diet and the rejuvenating power of food. Well, we're going to delve into that subject during this episode and find out more about chemical compounds known as phytochemicals, where we get them from, and why they help us to stay healthy. I'm joined by Dr. Navindra Seeram, one of the world's leading experts in the science of plant foods and natural products. We're going to discuss why foods rich in certain compounds are hugely beneficial in preventing some chronic conditions and explain the concept of using plants as a first line of defense against harmful diseases. Dr. Seeram is a professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Rhode Island here in the United States. Navindra, welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast.
Hey, Peter, thank you for having me.
It's great to talk to you. Difficult times that we're going through at the moment. I know everyone is working extremely hard, just getting used to a new way of working because of the coronavirus. So I do appreciate you making time.
Absolutely, Peter. We have to adapt, right?
This isn't going to be over quickly, is it? So we've got to find that new way of working. And you and I are talking, obviously, remotely at the moment. And it is amazing to me, isn't it, what we can do if we set our minds to it?
Hey, just like plants, you know, we adapt, we co-evolve, we figure out ways to make things work. Necessity is the mother of invention, after all, Peter.
Yeah, I quite agree. Look, before we delve into the science, I mentioned in the introduction that this episode is produced in association with Amazentis, and I wanted to give you an opportunity, for the purposes of full disclosure, for both of us, to talk about your involvement with the company and the work that they're doing.
Yes, Peter, thank you for clarifying that. As you mentioned, I'm a professor at the University of Rhode Island. I'm also the department chair for the Biomedical and Pharmaceutical Sciences Department. But I also serve on the scientific advisory board independently from the university for Amazentis.
Maybe let's talk a little bit about your background, first of all. I'm curious how you became interested in this area of science to start with.
So, Peter, I'm a third generation East Indian. I was born and I grew up in the South American country known then as British Guiana, now known as Guyana. I am a third generation East Indian, so my ancestors were brought from India to work in the sugar plantations after slavery was abolished as indentured servants. So growing up in a very poor third world country such as Guyana, we had to resort to what mom and grandma would tell us to use as sources of medicines. You know, pharmacies and physicians healthcare is not as accessible in Guyana as it is here in the United States. So as a very young kid growing up, I was very piqued by the traditional systems of medicines that was practiced, you know, in India, by the natives in Guyana, and therefore, you know, utilization of plants for preventing toothaches and tummy aches and so on.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you if you can think of some examples, maybe from your childhood, as to where plants would come in. And it almost became second nature to turn to a plant if you had a toothache, or if you had a bruise on your hand or a little cut, things that you might have instinctively used as medications.
Exactly. In fact, you know, even toothbrushes, we didn't have toothbrushes at one point. And you know, we'll take a black sage and, you know, we'll take it and rub it on your teeth and your gums. So there was a lot of different plants that mom and grandma would say to use. And, you know, in fact, Peter, you probably know this, but the WHO, you know, estimates that over 80% of the world's population still use plants as sources of medicines in all parts of the world.
My recollection from my childhood is when I grew up in Northeast England and in a rural environment, and if I was stung by a nettle, I would immediately reach for a dandelion leaf to rub on that swelling on my hand, and the pain would go away instantly.
And it's also interesting, you know, Peter, that, you know, it's not only the things which you don't think about in terms of plants, stuff that are non-edible, but there's so much in our medicine in terms of our spice cabinets, you know, garlic and chives and cumin and oregano and basil. And there was tons of stuff that mom and grandma would say, boil this, drink it as a tea or as a tincture or use it topically. So very, very fascinating when you think about plants and how they produce these phytochemicals, as you mentioned.
It is fascinating. So you were obviously hooked as a child in terms of your interest in this area. How did that evolve in terms of your education?
Right, Peter. So the University of Guyana, which is the only university that we have in terms of tertiary education, I went there and I got my bachelor's in chemistry. And at that point, I realized that for me to pursue, you know, further discovery of natural products from plants, that I had to go to grad school. And it turns out that in the beautiful island of Jamaica, in Kingston, Jamaica, there is the University of the West Indies, and they have and still do one of the best programs, PhD programs in natural product chemistry. So I journeyed. I was a young, I think just finished college, 20, 21 years old, went over to Jamaica, taught in a high school for a couple of years, and then went to grad school and continued on with my graduate studies and did my PhD there in Jamaica.
And eventually found your way to Michigan State University.
I did, Peter. But one important point, I think, you know, sometimes your career chooses you or you choose your career. I don't know which comes first. Is it chicken and the egg? But during my time finishing up my PhD, I worked in forensic sciences in Jamaica. And it's interesting, when you work in forensics, it's not only looking at drugs and arson cases, but also toxicology cases of poisons or drug overdoses in humans. And therefore, my interest as a natural product chemist was not only about what's in the plants, but because of my, you know, exposure to forensic science, kind of start wondering, you know, well, what happens when these phytochemicals get into the body? Just like toxins or poisons would do, or dietary phytochemicals, what happens. And I think, as you mentioned, by the time I hit Michigan for my Michigan State University for my postdoc, and then went on after that, that kind of, I don't know, the convergence or the, you know, the coming together of the different ideas and curiosities that you have kind of molds you in your career as you move forward.
That's interesting, because that is what science is all about, isn't it? It isn't just one thing. It's how different aspects of our lives and the natural world converge with each other.
Correct, Peter. And it's so interdisciplinary right now, as you know. You know, science, you know, there is no chemist or biochemist anymore. We all kind of converge and we cross fertilize. And I think, you know, for me personally, you know, my background, you know, my ethnicity, my West Indian, East Indian kind of mix, my moving to the United States to be exposed to cutting edge instrumentation kind of shaped my career and still continues, you know, in the future as I move along this pathway.
I was interested in Michigan. You studied the properties of tart cherries. And a lot of people today will swear on the use of tart cherries for many, many reasons, including getting a good night's sleep.
Correct. So I did my postdoc with a very esteemed natural product chemist, Murali Nair, Professor Nair. And at that time, I still think, still up to today, Michigan, the state of Michigan, is the largest producer and grower of tart cherries in the United States. So my postdoc project was, you know, working on the anthocyanins, or the pigments which make cherries red, and blueberries blue, or strawberries red, and pomegranates red, and the anthocyanins, it turns out, in tart cherries are very effective anti-inflammatory agents, and tart cherries are widely used for gout and arthritis and inflammation. And it just kind of made sense that it was the pigments in tart cherries that are actually partially responsible for some of those effects.
You mentioned, just going off a little tangent here, which is something I often do, but you mentioned the colour of different fruits. Why? And we hear so much, of course, these days about having a colourful salad as being beneficial to us. Why is the colour of a fruit or a vegetable so important?
Important. Now, I'm going to go off to a tangent, Peter, if you'll just indulge me for a second.
Please
here.
Do.
So it turns out, and I don't quote me on this, but it turns out that humans and birds, we're able to distinguish trichromatic. We're able to see a colorful berry against a dark leaf, green background. And, you know, when I came to URI, I actually did a very cool collaboration with a fantastic scientist here from Natural Resources, Scott McWilliams. We looked at migratory birds that would fly, you know, when they're moving off, you know, coming from north, going south to Block Island, which is a small island off the coast of the New England area. And it turns out that birds, just like humans, would stop.
And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Are you suffering from chronic disease? Or maybe you're trying to live to 120 and optimize your health? Either way, the Your Health, Your Story podcast is for you. My name's Casper Schultz, and I've been traveling the world meeting with top doctors and experts in medicine and health with amazing discoveries that are making the incurable curable. I decided I had to share these stories to empower others who are seeking solutions but just couldn't find them. So join us for weekly enlightening discussions on how to beat chronic disease and live an incredibly healthy life that you won't hear about elsewhere.
On Block Island, and they were able to, at this time of the year, there's not much insects for them to eat. So they would consume large quantities of berries, and they're able to distinguish and choose and select the more colorful ones. And I think our hypothesis, and still we're investigating it, is that the potential beneficial compounds from the berries that the birds would get and we do get kind of protects them, you know, their muscle and the inflammation that they're enduring as they fly, you know, they're super athletes. So for humans, I think, you know, as I just mentioned, you know, we co-evolved with plants, and maybe plants selected us to eat their colorful berries so that we could cultivate them. And we selected plants to grow them for their colorful berries so we could derive those health beneficial compounds that they produce. I don't know. It's a chicken and the egg again, but it's very fascinating when you think, when you think about that really close relationship we have with plants.
Well, it is. It is fascinating, in a sense, to see how we have evolved and how birds have evolved to have that almost that sixth sense to appreciate that different colours are beneficial for us.
Correct. Fascinating.
So let's talk about phytochemicals. We mentioned phytochemicals already, but let's delve into the science a little bit more. What exactly are they?
So phyto means plant. It's a Latin word meaning plant. So phytochemicals are plant chemicals. Now, people don't like chemicals. They think chemicals are synthetic and bad for you. So there is a term that's coined, phytonutrients. And it's used alternatively to refer to phytochemicals. But these compounds that plants produce are non-nutrients. In other words, plants produce, and we know a plant diet is very healthy for us because it's good fiber, vitamins are there, some minerals are there, maybe some good fats are there. But the compounds, these phytochemicals, are secondary metabolites that the plants produce, and they vary within the plant kingdom. Certain plants within a certain genus or certain types, like the cruciferous, the cabbage family, they produce a similar type of compounds, or the berries will produce a similar type of phytochemicals. So the thought is that these phytochemicals are produced by the plant to give the plant a competitive advantage. So maybe I'm colorful, eat me, disperse of my seeds, or cultivate me, or I'm toxic, stay away from me. Right? Stay away. Do not eat my leaves, herbivores, or you're going to die because, you know, I need my leaves. So, we don't know why the plants produce them, but for sure, you know, the edible ones, the edible phytochemicals, or the so-called quote unquote phytonutrients, we know are potentially beneficial for us.
So just to be clear, and just to pass out the science that you've just been discussing there, when we say that they are secondary metabolites, in other words, they are not macronutrients like fat, protein, fiber, vitamins that people are very familiar with, yet they are still hugely important.
Correct. So they are not macronutrients or micronutrients, as you just clarified. These are not fats and carbohydrates and proteins and fiber or vitamins and minerals. They are actually secondary metabolites. So they're not primary metabolites. They are produced, again, by plants in certain cases to potentially give the plant a biological competitive advantage. And humans potentially, by eating these compounds, can get a beneficial, health beneficial effect also.
So when we talk about deriving drugs from natural sources like plants, what kind of medicinal compounds, and maybe historically, what kind of medicinal compounds are we talking about that are beneficial to us?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So phytopharmaceuticals are those drugs which were obtained from plants. And as you know, I work, I teach in the College of Pharmacy. There is a discipline called pharmacognosy. And if you have not heard that word before, pharmacognosy is the quote-unquote mother of pharmacy. It is where pharmacy started, where humans were learning how to take extracts from plants, their leaves, grind them up, and actually use these for medicinal purposes. And as Eastern medicine and Western medicine kind of moved over time during the Renaissance period, and that's Hippocrates, as you mentioned, and many other great scholars, humans started to figure out that by isolating individual compounds from plants, that these could be developed into drugs. Very good examples. Aspirin, you know, that little pill that's been around for 100 years, is actually a derivative of salicylic acid, which is found in the bark of the willow. And in medieval England, when they, you know, they would chew on the bark of the willow and pain would go away, inflammation would go away. And it was, you know, later that scientists at Merck isolated salicylic acid, derivatized it, and then aspirin was born. Similarly, there are other drugs like digoxin, a cardiac glycoside from the digitalis plant. There's caffeine from coffee or tea. There is cancer drugs, vincristine and vinblastine from the Madagascar periwinkle, nicotine, artemisinin for anti-malaria, quinine, and the list continues. Tobacco, nicotine, right, from the tobacco plant. So tons of medicinal compounds, of course, toxic ones too, I should clarify. Stimulants, hallucinogenic compounds, psychedelic compounds, the list is just mind-boggling.
We are literally talking about thousands, aren't we?
Thousands. And we're still discovering more. And, you know, it's interesting that the compounds exist naturally within the matrix of the plant. And sometimes when we cook the plant or derivatize it like in a beverage or extract it, we actually modify and change some of these compounds too. So it's not only what's in the plant naturally itself, it's also what we modify when we crush a garlic clove, for example. And so it's also how we consume them. And then it's also what happens when it gets into the body, right? As we referred to earlier.
And as you imply there, it can sometimes be only certain parts of the plant. It isn't necessarily the whole plant that is going to be beneficial to us. And I guess that's where the science is important, to identify which part of the plant, whether it's the seed or the pith or the skin, presumably,
correct,
that is most valuable to us.
Correct, Peter. The compounds could be tissue specific. So what is in the fruit may not be what is in the leaves or what is in the bark. Like a cancer drug called Taxol. Paclitaxel is in the bark of the Pacific yew. That's another good example of a phytopharmaceutical. But yeah, you're right. So a fruit may be edible and the leaf may be toxic of the same plant. There could be overlap or there could be entirely distinct in what they contain.
And I mention that because people talk a lot about whole foods, and I think there's a great value in talking about whole foods being beneficial to us. But we do need to know and understand the science to get the most benefit out of what we're eating, because we could be misguided, I think, sometimes perhaps in eating too much of a wrong kind of plant or too much of a certain kind of plant. And I mean, I'll give one little example. I went through a phase in my life because I thought, and I believe still, that almonds are very good for you. Nuts generally are good for you. If you eat too many almonds, perhaps you might be getting too much of a certain compound that can result in kidney stones.
Yeah.
You've got to be careful. And that's where education is so important, isn't it?
Correct. Yeah. In fact, almonds contain a compound called amygdalin. Amygdalin is a cyanide-containing molecule. It's found in certain other plants like yucca or cassava. And in Africa and in South America, where I grew up, you know, mom, they would boil cassava and throw away the water before consuming the cassava. So we kind of figured out how to get rid of the non-toxic stuff from foods. Very fascinating when you think of pharmacognosy and the evolution of traditional systems of medicine like TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, or Ayurveda, the Indian system of medicine, and how we practice Western medicine. You know, with the traditional systems of medicine being very personalized, and you know, with meditation being a part of it, and a healthy lifestyle and exercise, it's very holistic. You know, so it's a whole food as well as a holistic approach to health. And to your show here, Peter Lama, you know, you know all about the health span and the lifespan, and I'm speaking to the expert right now.
Well, that's very kind of you. That is exactly what we are all about. Living long and health span is the phrase that I use all the time, of course. Living as long as possible, just optimizing the number of healthy years that we have.
That's right, Peter.
Let's talk about pomegranates. You have written a book about pomegranates. You mentioned them earlier. And very, very coincidentally to this interview, I today just ordered 3 pomegranate trees for my garden. Happened to be doing a bit of landscaping because we were hit by a fire a few months ago, a California wildfire, so replacing a few trees. And pomegranates actually survive very well in Southern California. The climate really suits them. So I've got a special interest in pomegranates for maybe more than one reason. But you are an expert in terms of their medicinal qualities. What drew you to them as something that you wanted to study?
Yes, Peter. So as we mentioned, you know, I finished my postdoc at Michigan State. I was working with tart cherries, and then I moved to UCLA, University of California in Los Angeles, right in your backyard, I think, Peter. I worked with a very famous physician. He's also a PhD, David Heber. And at that time, you know, as you just mentioned, you know, pomegranates were really hitting, you know, the United States big time. So as we all know, or we may not know, it's really a Mediterranean plant. It's from Persia. That's where it was originally grown. And because California has this beautiful Mediterranean temperature, pomegranates grew very well in the beautiful state of California. And Palm Wonderful, a company at that time that was producing pomegranate juice, squeezing the whole pomegranate fruit, you know, we're very interested, you know, with our group at that time in kind of understanding, you know, what were the health benefits of pomegranate juice. And so that was where our work really started, in terms of understanding the chemistry of what's present in pomegranate juice, as well as, you know, what happens when the compounds get into the body.
And there's a long history, of course, and pomegranates are mentioned in many religions. The records of their use go back centuries.
Yes, it's mentioned in all of the holy books, in the Bible, in the Quran, in the Torah. It's supposedly the apple in the Garden of Eden. You know, it's regarded as a king of fruits. It has a crown on it, as you think about, you know, you look at a pomegranate. It's the only species in its family. So the plant itself, it's the only member in its whole family. So that's pretty interesting also. A Punica granatum, it means like a grenade. And if you were to cut a pomegranate open, you'll see the juicy sacs of those areoles, the edible part of the fleshy coat around the seeds, which if you were to eat those, you'll consume these anthocyanins, which are the compounds we mentioned earlier found in cherries and berries. But it's also interesting when you look at the chemistry of the pomegranate that the pith, so if you were to cut it open, that white part of the fruit, as well as its peel or its husk, that leathery rind, also contains a large quantity of polyphenols that are known as elagitannins. And therefore, if you were to squeeze a whole pomegranate fruit to extract its juice, you're actually squeezing out, you know, not only the anthocyanins, that to give it that beautiful red color, but also these elagitannins or polyphenols found in the peel of the fruit.
So it is a good example then of the entire fruit being beneficial to us and different qualities depending on whether we're talking about the pith or the juice, depending on how it's used.
Correct. And you could imagine one would not eat a pomegranate rind. It's bitter. But, you know, imagine squeezing a whole orange. So compounds in the peel of that whole orange would also be extracted into orange juice. I think it's a similar analogy here. And whilst we may think that pomegranate peel may not be edible, the Indian system of medicine, Ayurveda, they would use anardana, the spice that was obtained from pomegranate seeds and also its rind. And I've also heard anecdotally that if you were to go to certain parts of Turkey and Middle Eastern countries, Persia, they would take the pomegranate fruit and then they would kind of massage it and soften it to a point where they could stick a straw into it and then drink that juice. So, you know, they're consuming what's in the peel into that juice if you kind of soften and roll that fruit around.
So let's just extrapolate a little bit then in terms of what happens when we eat a pomegranate and why and how it is beneficial to us, because we all respond in different ways depending on what's going on in our guts, and we're all different as human beings. So how are we benefiting, and scientifically, what is going on when we eat a pomegranate?
Correct. So Peter, as a pharmacy professor, you know, we teach our students, our pharmacists about ADME, you know, pharmaceutical science students about ADME, A-D-M-E, A being absorption, D, distribution, M, metabolism, and E, excretion. And when you think of drugs or xenobiotics or foreign substances that enters the body into your through your mouth, as it gets into your stomach, you know, these compounds are actually exposed to high pH. Low pH, high acidity. And many of the compounds just degrade and are broken down into smaller molecules, which are then absorbed and gets into circulation. And then they're distributed and metabolized by the liver enzymes. So what may end up into the bloodstream may not be what's actually in the fruit itself. As well as you just alluded to, compounds that are then traversing from the stomach and getting into the small and then large intestine, and they would sit in the large intestine for a while, and then they're further now metabolized by gut microbiota, the gut microflora. I think the last I've heard, there's over 100 trillion different types, not species, but a lot of bacteria in your gut, and which depends on an individual. So
that's a mind-blowing number, isn't it?
It is. As people know, you know, if your gut is not right, then you're not right. And, you know, with inter-individual variability, not only in genetic polymorphisms, but also in your gut microbiota composition, you could imagine that one could probably, you know, break down these compounds differently than your twin would, you know, or your brother would. So fascinating.
And the impact on us can be whole body, including the brain.
Correct. Because once the compounds are metabolized into different sizes and different forms, some of them can actually cross the BBB, the blood-brain barrier, which is this thick, waxy layer that protects the brain, you know, from circulation. So some compounds could get into the brain. They could get into other tissues of the body. You could excrete them and pass them into your urine and feces. And you could get into this, what's called enterohepatic circulation too, where from the colon, the compounds are absorbed into circulation, converted again by the liver enzymes. And then this continuous flux of compounds circulating, if you're consuming, you know, pomegranate juice, for example, you know, regularly, or green tea regularly, or red wine regularly, or eating your nuts and berries regularly.
So let's get to the heart of the matter with urolithin A, which you've mentioned, but let's delve into that in a little bit more detail. And it's one of the metabolites that we can get from pomegranates, and we need the right bacteria to reap the rewards. Can you explain the process?
Yes. So the dilemma that we had, and we still do as a field in our, as a scientist in the field of polyphenol chemistry, is sometimes we cannot explain the physiological effects based on levels of compounds you'll find in circulation. So in other words, you know, polyphenols, elagitannins included, are generally regarded as being very poorly bioavailable, meaning that the compounds are not being absorbed into blood in large quantities or physiological level, relevant levels to see a biological effect. So the dilemma is, well, if what's in the fruit is not getting into the blood, then what's responsible for the health benefit or the health beneficial effects of what is known for the fruit? And the urolithins include a host of urolithins. One of them is urolithin A. There's also urolithin B, C, D, and so on. Urolithin A is the most abundant and prevalent among the urolithins. But again, you know, if you do not have the microbes which are able to do that conversion, then you wouldn't be a responder or a producer of urolithins, if that makes sense.
So we're not all responders then?
We're not all responders. So it's interesting. I know I'm a responder because it turns out, you know, in some of our earlier studies, I'm able to detect urolithins, you know, in my urine using mass spec methods if I consume pomegranate. But no, we're not all responders. You have to have that gut microbe, that the microbes that do the conversion. And we don't know what percentage of people are responders and who are not. And we don't even know if a non-responder can become a responder if you consume foods over time. So there's a lot of unknowns about urolithins present in humans from the consumption of the elagitannin-rich foods.
And is it black and white? You're either a responder or not, or can there be gradients? Can you be a partial responder?
Yeah, it's you could be a responder or not, and you could be a responder that produces some types of urolithins and not. And so, I think what needs to happen is a really large clinical study that really looks at people with different, you know, consuming the elagitannins, and then really trying to understand how much we produce, what we produce, who is a responder and who is not. A lot of unknowns.
In terms of testing to find out if we are a responder, what does that involve?
Well, it would involve, as I just mentioned, you know, collecting some urine samples after you've consumed the elagitannin-rich food.
Right.
Or pomegranate in this case, and then finding the urolithin glucuronidated form because it's excreted in your urine. Also, there are some blood samples that has been people are looking at. I know we'll talk about this later. Amazentis, a company, the Swiss biotech company, they're developing methods to actually diagnose and find out quickly if you're producing urolithins or not.
Just to talk a little bit more about the benefits of urolithin A, it's mitochondrial health that is so crucial. And of course, mitochondrial health is vital for all of us every day in terms of our energy.
Correct. So the mitochondria is a powerhouse of the cell. And urolithin A is actually an activator of mitophagy. So it actually helps the recycling of dead mitochondria and then improves, you know, cellular function, which has been shown, you know, in several studies in worms, in nematodes, C. elegans, and also in rodents. And there's some emerging human clinical studies to also support the effects of urolithin A in muscle function.
And that's why it sometimes gets the label anti-aging. And that's an expression I don't like because I don't believe in anti-aging. I think positive aging is perhaps a more useful expression, or simply aging well. But nevertheless, anti-aging, because we can be 70 years old and have good muscle strength and perhaps feel like we're 50 years old. And mitochondria are obviously crucial in that process.
You're right, Peter. That's correct.
So let's move on to, and you mentioned the work that Amazentis are doing and the product MitoPure Urolithin A. What is the distinction between a highly pure and proprietary form of Urolithin A and the Urolithin A that we've just been talking about? And we'll continue this conversation in just a moment.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Right. So, as I mentioned, Amazentis is a Swiss biotech company. And, you know, when we started, you know, talking about more than 10 years ago, you know, they were quite interested in what were the health benefits of what's in pomegranate. And as they narrowed down and looked at urolithin A and have published, you know, some really good papers on the compound, as I mentioned, in nematodes and in animals, in rodents, and also in humans, is that they have developed this MitoPure, which is a proprietary formulation of urolithin A, which is highly bioavailable. The MitoPure that's developed by Amazentis has been shown in clinical studies to be effective, to be bioavailable, to be safe and tolerable in humans. So it's you know, it's well tested. You know, it's an effective product.
And as a product, as a scientist, is it something that excites you for the future?
It is, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you want to get the best benefits from your foods and you have so much uncertainties in what you're eating or how you're processing it, or are you able to produce it? Are you a responder or a non-responder? And there's so much unknowns because it's such personalized, that the best bang for your buck is really to get to the actual compound, which is bioactive. And if there's a way that you could consume MitoPure and then get the benefits directly of your urolithin A, irregardless, irrespective of if you're a producer or not, or you just don't like pomegranate juice, or you just don't want to eat berries, or you want to supplement and you want to get bioactive levels of the compounds in a sufficient dose, then I think let's cut to the chase and get exactly to the bioactive compound. And that's what Amazentis is providing in their MitoPure product.
Yeah, and I asked that question because my views on supplementation have evolved over the years. And I used to be from the school of, well, if we eat a balanced diet with good fruits and vegetables, organic foods, wherever possible, that we are probably getting enough of everything that we need in terms of vitamins and minerals and proteins and fats and carbohydrates, that we're probably going to be okay and that we don't need supplementation. Now, I've evolved to the point, and this conversation helps to explain how complex we are as human beings and how even with that, let's say, in quotes, perfect balanced diet, we may still not be fully benefiting from the natural foods. And therefore, as we understand further the science, the supplementation, it's almost like an insurance policy to fill in the gaps of what we're not getting from the natural world.
That's right. You know, you hit the nail on the head there, Peter. It's like an insurance policy, because supplementation, dietary supplementation, is meant to supplement, not to replace. And in, as you just said, indeed, you could be consuming a wholesome diet. But if you're not a responder, then you wouldn't be producing urolithin A. And if urolithin A is one of the constituents or one of the bioactive compounds that's formed in humans, and we've shown that that has a health benefit, then supplement with it, because you may not be getting it from your diet.
I'd like to just maybe broaden the conversation out a little bit more now and get your thoughts on personalized medicine. In other words, medicine directed at an individual. And as you've explained, we are all supremely different in terms of how our bodies work. And there is a lot of talk these days about personalized medicine. How much do you think that is part of our future?
I think it has to be, because, you know, there's no one size fits all. And as I alluded to earlier, the view of traditional systems of medicine like TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, or Ayurveda, you know, if you were to see a practitioner, they would actually look at you, Peter, and stick out your tongue and look at your eyes and give you a diet that includes herbs and other things and have, it's really structured for you. It's for Peter Bowes. And I think we're finding now that in the field of drugs, at least in cancer chemotherapeutic drugs, for example, where you may have certain genes that makes you more, you know, liable or prone to getting a certain predisposition to a certain type of cancer, and drugs that may work for certain people and may not work for other people. And I think you could extend that personalized precision medicine and personalized nutrition to what we're talking about with these phytochemicals. Because again, because of our genetic predisposition, our polymorphisms, the stuff that we have in our gut, the gut microbiota, maybe what's good for Peter Bose is not what's good for Navendra Serum. Maybe I could eat green tea and drink green tea and eat broccoli and eat pomegranates, and I'm responding and I'm producing different things, and Peter Bose just lacks those microflora and is not able to. And so I think it's very interesting, again, that therefore with what's happening with drugs may also be the same for foods. And whilst we don't understand everything as yet, elagitannins are not the only compounds which are converted by gut microbiota into further metabolites. There are other classes of polyphenols that's been well known. Lignans, which are found like in flaxseed, even tea, compounds in tea. So it's not just elagitannins that go through this conversion by gut microbiota. It's other polyphenols also, and other phytochemicals also. So we're really at the tip of the iceberg, and there's so much that we do not know. What Amazentis has done here, advancing MitoPure to a point where we can actually consume the product, is really forging, I think, pushing the barriers forward faster. And I think this is just a trend that's going to have to happen as we understand more about what's really beneficial in the body and what's getting to the tissues and what's exactly we need, which may be quite different from what's in the food itself.
I think one of the challenges ahead is going to be in terms of sharing the value of this science with populations at large, with society, is making the benefits and these supplementations affordable for a vast number of people, because that is one of the, of course, the great ills of our society, that a lot of diseases can be prevented en masse if only people could afford the foods and the medicines that can do that. We understand what's needed, we understand the science, but it's the availability to vast numbers of people that's increasingly important.
Correct, because if you were a responder, to get back to our analogy of doing exactly what you said there, Peter, you know, you may not want to drink pomegranate juice because it has sugars, and you may have diabetes, and you don't want the calories and the sugar that's coming with that food itself. Or if you're eating the fruit and you don't want to eat the rind, or maybe someone wants to take a pomegranate extract. You don't know if that extract is standardized. You don't know where it's coming from. It's not been clinically tested. So ultimately, exactly right. How do we get a bioactive compound to get to most people in a very convenient form, in a form that's calibrated and known to be bioavailable, affordable? And those are some of the things that we have to think of globally.
And I think one of the other challenges is simply education, because we are oftentimes, more often than not indeed, look at television advertising, bombarded with information about what is supposedly good for us, what's not good for us, what is affordable. And people, I think quite rightly, are often so deluged with information that they are confused about what they should be eating. And for us to move forward and to benefit the most number of people, education really does have to be focused on advising people what they should eat and why they should eat it.
Correct, Peter. You know, education starts, you know, I'm a professor. I'm a teacher first and foremost, as well as a researcher. So it starts in the classroom. It extends into the lab, into my grad students and postdocs. And it also entails me going to scientific meetings and presenting not only to my peers, but also to the laypersons too, to trade meetings, to dietitian meetings, to meetings which, you know, we wouldn't be able to get to the masses doing podcasts such as yours right now, Peter. So we're educating the folks who are listening in. And I have to admit, you know, we don't have all the answers. We're still learning. But what we know now is more than we knew yesterday or 10 years ago. And what we'll know 10 years from now is more than we'll know today. So this is just a building logically on the next steps of what we're learning to ultimately get the bioactive constituents to humans to have them, you know, have a better health span and lifespan.
And this is why science and the funding of science is so important.
It is. And, you know, without the funding, you know, where do you get the money from to do these clinical studies? And I know I'm actually excited and happy that, you know, a company, a biotech company like Amazentis can really push the boundaries faster and further than if we were to try to rely on just federal sources of funding. You know, however we get to that point, you know, if it's pharmaceutical companies, if it's biotech companies, if it's dietary supplement companies, if it's food companies, but, you know, the science is good. The science is peer reviewed and it's been published and vetted. And therefore, it's good science. Good science is good science. It doesn't matter where the funding comes from.
And in the meantime, we move forward with the knowledge that we have. And one of the rules of thumb that I often use when I don't fully understand the implications of eating a certain diet is to keep it simple. And I'm one of those people who have a really simple diet. And I don't eat much meat, but I eat a lot of vegetables. And if in doubt, leave it out is generally my motto when it comes to food. I'm just curious as to what you do in terms of your own diet.
Yeah, Peter, you said it at the very start, you know, you are what you eat, you know, let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. I'm a big proponent of a high plant-based diet. I integrate a lot of fruit and vegetables in my diet. My wife, she's ethnic Indian like me, but West Indian. She grew up in Jamaica, so there's a lot of spices in our foods and curries and hot pepper, capsaicin. I drink a lot of coffee and red wine, moderately, of course. But yes, you know, I try to educate my kids in their palates in what they were exposed to when they were kids, so that they can kind of learn and to enjoy the taste of good foods. You know, I came to URI, you know, about 11 years ago. I started working in maple, you know, and trying to understand what's different with maple syrup. It's another conversation for another day versus, you know, pancake syrup. So the natural foods versus this, you know, these processed foods. So, you know, you can never get it right. But as you just said, Peter, we try to keep it simple. You know, and do the best that we can.
And how much do you think about your own health span? I often ask that question to experts in the field of longevity science, and it's always interesting to me the answer in terms of how people like you apply the science that you yourself are working on to your own life, perhaps with 30 or 40 years in the future in mind.
Well, I'll tell you this, Peter. Thank you for asking that. It's a very personal question, as you know. I'm in my early 50s. I just outlived my dad, you know, and you know, for males in my family growing up in a poor third world country, their lifespan is not much. You know, there's no dental care, health care, exercising, the diets that we know now, you know, is not what they were used to. And so for me, you know, living longer than my dad has lived, you know, I want to live to see my kids and my kids' kids and my kids' kids' kids. You know, I want to see my descendants and enjoy them and live a full life where I can interact with them and be, you know, cognitively sharp. It's okay if I don't remember where my car keys are, but to have those beautiful memories and for me, you know, that's what's important, because I think that everything that I can do right now to give me that extra day to spend with my family is worth it.
And I think that's a wonderful way to end this. Navendra Seeram, thank you very much. Really fascinating conversation.
Peter, thank you for having me. It was really a pleasure talking to you too.
And if you'd like to read more about Dr. Seeram's work, I'll put the details in the show notes of this episode. You'll find them at the Live Long and Master Aging website. We use the acronym LAMA, so it's lamapodcast.com, LLAMApodcast.com. This episode of the LAMA Podcast was brought to you in association with Amazentis, a Swiss life science company pioneering cutting-edge, clinically validated cellular nutrition under its Timeline brand. And if you enjoy what we do, you can rate and review us at Apple Podcasts. You can follow us in social media at LAMA Podcast, and you can direct message me at Peter Bowes. Many thanks for listening. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate your skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexB, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code Llama at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.